Hi, you're listening to the Full Life Podcast with Melanie Lynham. Hello, I am so glad that you are joining me right now. This episode is a celebration of the Full Life Podcast first birthday. That's right. Happy birthday to all my listeners and to those of you who have been listening from the very day I launched. Thank you for coming on this journey with me. Shout out to my amazing guests who have so generously shared your stories, your wisdom, and your faith with us. And to my dad, who was the very first person to sow financially into this ministry, essentially paying for my microphone. Thanks, Dad. Love you. Now, this episode is a pot of gold, and what I mean by that is I've gone through some of my favorite episodes and pulled out some really powerful, profound moments, interesting stories, and put them together here for you in this one episode. These are some of the moments that have impacted me the most, and I thought that in celebration of the year that has been, it would be good to go back and have another listen to them. And just in case, at any point you think, wow, I really need to have a listen to more of that episode, I've included the episode details in the show notes. Let's start by going all the way back to episode 1 with John and Christine Carby. This is their story about how they felt the call and made the decision to pick up their young family and move over to the Philippine Islands to build and run a school.
So we went home and then we sort of asked God, okay, we need some kind of confirmation. We didn't tell anybody except for our like parents or something. And then so we would go to church and we would be praying and sort of waiting. And in my whole Christian journey, I'd never had any like, ta-da movements, like, you know, the ray of light coming down. Or
this is God.
This is God speaking. Yeah. So I didn't know how this was ever going to happen. I was like, I was sort of saying, like, thinking to God, God, I really need one of those because it's a big thing that we're going to do. And the more, I think.
Can I jump in? This is like sort of, it was only over the space of about 2 weeks where this was sort of going on.
Wow, that's
like, this was a pretty quick, passionate time frame where we're going, God, we want your confirmation. We want it now. There was a prophet. What was the prophet's name? Dave McCracken.
Yeah.
A well-known prophet that goes to Life Church quite often. And and I just had it in my soul that this prophecy was going to come on me, that he was going to pick me out of the 400 to 500
people. You probably
wanted
it more.
I did. Yeah. I was sure of it, which was crazy because the story was that we're in the church that day with 500 people, those wearing green to get his attention because apparently...
I wasn't.
I didn't know this, but there was people who wear green because
really?
Apparently he's more drawn to green. When he's prophesying, like, this is all the speculation. Yeah, I don't even know if it's green, but I'm like, oh, okay. But anyway, I was standing next to Christine's dad at the time, and I remember it well because he prophesied over a few people, and he'd worked through this part of the church, and he was coming around us, and then he was like, it's like everything was quiet. He's like, you, sir, and he's pointed right at me. And my heart started, you know what I mean? It was like
pounding.
It's like you in the glasses. And I wasn't wearing glasses.
Oh, no.
It was David Love, which is Christine's dad, who was next to me. And he looked at me and he bit his lip. He's like, sorry, I just stole your prophecy. And you can talk to him. He remembers the story quite well. And honestly, my heart sank a little bit until I swallowed my pride a bit and listened to the prophecy that was before David Love, which was a... which was an epic prophecy for the family and for him and for his wife. So
that's great.
So, but I was a little bit dejected after that. And I was like, I felt that this was it.
Yeah. And I think during that week, we actually decided, we said, okay, well, it felt good with us within our heart.
Yeah. Like, we talked, we prayed.
And we sort of said, all right, we're going to make the decision. We'll put our house on the market. And literally that next week at church...
This was our stepping out in faith moment. We said, we're going to follow you in faith, not from confirmation.
Yeah. Right. And so the next week at church, we were in church and you know how normally like midway through the service, like, okay, anyone needs any prayers? And everyone's, if you need a prayer for something, everyone puts their hand up and then people pray with you and pray for you. And the girl behind me... She prayed for me. And then after the service, she's like, oh, Christine, when I was praying for you, I had a vision. And I was like,
at that point, I was like already in like tears. Because I was like, that's never ever happened to me in my whole life of anybody saying anything that was good. And I'll just read what she said to me in a minute. So it said, along the most beautiful beach, I saw God walking along with you and John on either side, and Chile was on his shoulders. As he was walking along, he was guiding you and sharing with you. As you neared the end of the beach, there was like a white veil curtain. And when you got to the curtain, you stopped and two angels opened it. What I saw was indescribably beautiful. It was like paradise. You and John fell to your knees and Chili curled up, who was our youngest daughter at the time, curled up on John's lap. God stood behind you and put his hands on your heads and said, don't limit what I can do for you. I give you more than you could ever believe for. I have gone before you and prepared the way. Trust in me and I will guide you there.
Wow.
So for that us.
Out
that
of was, the blue.
Yeah. And that was like what we used that for. That was our extra confirmation that what we were doing is right. But I don't think it would have come unless we stepped out in faith first. Yeah. And we've experienced that so many times since this time even that stepping out first, sometimes then God will come and meet you there.
Even the week following was just, once that confirmation came through after we stepped out, the house sold, was under the contract within that week.
Yeah, well above asking price.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And I was even just toying with it at one point. I'm saying, just ask for another 2,000 and it would come back, yep.
Wow.
It's like, okay, like if you're going to confirm it, you confirm it.
Yeah, and then so then we had sold our house and we actually moved back in with my parents. And and during this time, I'd actually gotten pregnant with Asha, our youngest. So we were also expecting a baby. And the people in the Philippines as well who we'd partnered with, obviously, we were super excited and keen and all this kind of stuff. And they'd sort of gone silent and haven't been really talking to us much.
So we'd sold our house.
Oh, yeah.
We'd moved in with the in-laws. We were uprooting our lives to save for this year to get to this target that we had.
Yeah, saving money and...
saving money of this financial goal that we tried to get to so we could build the school and start our house and everything like that.
Mm.
And the people that we were partnering with in the Philippines... didn't talk to us. They wouldn't respond to our messages. They wouldn't.
Yeah.
They like basically left us dark.
So, but we still felt, we still just pushed ahead and just kept going, and that was fine for us. And then, so finally in 2015, we had Asha in January, early January.
She was actually born on the date that we envisioned ourselves leaving.
Wow.
So we had, early into it, we wanted to leave on her date, and then that was the date she was actually born, or her due date, which was a few days earlier.
Yeah.
So we had to delay things by a few months.
So 9 weeks. So when she was 9 weeks, we left.
9 weeks.
Nine weeks. First round of vaccinations.
Yeah. Wow. And then off you go.
Including some of the bigger ones like TB and some of the scarier diseases that luckily in Australia we don't have to really deal with anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So then we went over and then, pretty much we hit the ground running. Our house hadn't been built yet or anything, which we thought it would have been, but it wasn't.
No.
It was like, welcome to the Philippines. This is how things get done here. Never on time.
Where did you live in the meantime?
John went over just before us.
So the first few weeks was Christine learning the school that exists in Cebu already.
Yeah, and then John went over and helped finish our house to a livable state.
Okay.
And then we went over.
I just want to clarify here for our listeners who might not be familiar with the Philippine Islands. Cebu is actually not on the island that Siargao is on.
We were in Cebu first and then John went over to our island. He took this big mammoth 2-day voyage on a little bunker boat.
It was horrible. It was horrible. But truth be told, it was actually a moment that I had with God. I was on a boat for 2 days, 48 hours.
I found out
now it shouldn't have taken that long. We might have got lost.
Took that long for John to grow, probably.
And it was. I was in that boat. I was sleeping on a box of tiles for most of the 48 hours. It wasn't a boat that there was any room to stretch out, sleep or anything. And I was like, at one point, I'm like, God, help me get comfortable. Help me to sleep, because I think I was about 36 hours in and I hadn't slept because it was on tiles.
Yeah.
And the word from God was, look around you. And everybody was asleep in the same situation, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
All these local Filipino builder guys were asleep on the floor, on the tiles, on the cement. And God said, look around you. It's like your level of comfort has to change, buddy. Like,
wow.
And I slept for the next 12 hours like a log.
Mm-hmm.
I woke up sore, but it was one of my first revelations in there. It's like, you're not in Australia anymore. Comfort isn't what you think it is anymore.
Like
it's it's a different level of comfort. Change your attitude. And I slept. I slept like a baby after that.
Okay, grab some tissues because this next story tugs on the heartstrings. This is from episode 4 with Marika Hazard. Marika is a young woman in her 30s whose husband, Tim, passed away from a brain tumor about 5 years ago. Marika shares with us one of the worst experiences of her life and how she felt forsaken by God. After Tim passed, Marika found herself unsure if she would continue in her faith.
When we got to the fourth brain tumor, they no longer want to operate because they just believe it will just keep coming back. So we went into palliative care. And I didn't really know what palliative care was.
Okay.
I didn't appreciate that it's pretty much just a room and it's like they just let you die there. They just leave you alone. So when we were admitted to hospital in palliative care, I was with Tim and I'd never really experienced this type of coma before either, where they're sitting up and making jokes and completely fine, and then within the next 10 minutes they're not okay and they've gone into a coma and you don't know if they're going to wake up out of it again.
Did he?
No.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so and that night it was one of the worst experiences of my life. I was with Tim throughout that night and we were in this room and he started doing this sort of violent vomiting that he would do when he was having an episode, and he'd have seizures at the same time, and I'm alone with him in this room and I'm trying to hold him up so he can sit up and vomit, but because he's fallen into this coma and, you know, with the steroids, they also put on a lot of fluid and a lot of weight.
Right.
He was dead weight. He was
Did you press the help button?
Yeah. Yeah. And I literally couldn't hold him.
Mm.
I'm trying to push him to sit up so that he could vomit properly so he wouldn't choke.
Mm.
And I couldn't. And that moment was so, such a vulnerable moment for me, and I just remember just crying out to God, I need your help, just, and it's really interesting, in that moment I felt very alone, and actually that's right, I remember now, the buzzer for help was on the other side of the bed, and I'm trying at the same time to grab it, and I'm literally slipping, like I'm slipping and I just can't hold him up, and it's just one of those really, really intense life moments. And sort of afterwards I remember having this conversation with the nurses and just saying, look, I can't do this, I can't do this on my own, I need help, I need support. And they were a little bit surprised and said, oh, you know, this is sort of just the room where, you know, you just do what you need to do. And I'm like, what? I didn't appreciate what palliative care really was. And they ended up moving us to another area, which really wasn't any better. And there was a little moment where Tim had some kind of consciousness, but it wasn't very much at all. And he gave me this kiss on the cheek.
Aww.
Yeah. But I didn't really know what was going on. You know, I've always had this this question with God over the last four years since that moment. God, when I was in that room with Tim and I called out to you, it's the only time in my life where I felt like I probably needed you to answer more than any other time, and I didn't hear you. And I didn't feel your help and I didn't feel your hand. And what was with that? You know, what was with that moment? And he showed me about 2 years afterwards that, because what I was feeling was forsaken. I felt like he just wasn't there when I needed him to be there. And he showed me that he actually chose, he didn't forsake me in that moment. He actually chose me for that moment. And a lot of the time we just can't see everything, but God can. And he never leaves us and he doesn't forsake us because you know, when Jesus cried out on the cross, "Why have you forsaken me, God?" You know, everything Jesus went through was for us. And so he has never left me, and I know that. It was just that he chose me for that moment. And that's given me so much peace. I really see God for who he is. And I was walking down the back of my mom's property, and I suppose it was one of those moments where you go, you know, what do I do here? Do I continue in this faith? Everything that I was reading in the scriptures all of a sudden didn't seem to add up to me anymore, because I felt like I did everything it said. And or do you walk away from it all? Mm. And I was walking, yeah, down the back, and I was looking around, and I have this knowing that God has created all things, that he is the intricate, amazing designer. And I just couldn't believe in a happy coincidence of evolution whatsoever. I just knew that God created it all and that he created me. And I remember looking up at the sky and just going, well, I know that you've created me. And if you are God and I am who I am, then you are God to be worshipped, and I will worship you. And so that changed how I live, how I see everything. So from that moment on, I was no longer living my life as a Christian from my doctrinal beliefs that I'd built up since I was 6 years old and my biblical understanding. Mm. I was living as a created being that only knew to worship God, only knew, okay, well, how to do that. And yeah. So that's where I started from again. It's almost like I went back to my, it's almost like 20 years of faith was just like wiped out, and I just started all over again. Just walking with God as a child again, just worshiping him because he's God.
Wow.
So that really changed how I saw life. And yeah. So my journey since then, which has been, yeah, the last 4 years, has been just a journey of worship. And he is amazing the way he works. He took me from that place of not even being able to read the scripture again,
mm.
to a place where, you know, I can read his word, and his Holy Spirit is in me and speaking to me, and I'm getting insight, and I'm reading all those verses that I read before that all of a sudden I couldn't understand and didn't make sense, and there is truth and meaning in every single word. And he has re-established me in all that, and he taught me. One of the greatest things he taught me through the whole experience was the sacrifice of worship. That to worship when it's easy is one thing, but to choose to worship him when it's really difficult, mm. when you don't feel like it, when you physically can't do it,
yeah.
to choose to do it in those moments, you are bringing him this greater sacrifice. To his throne of grace of worship.
Our next story comes from episode 16 with Debbie Hill. Debbie and her husband Ron have spent their lives caring for and ministering to the poor, the destitute, and the addicts, not just in a pastoral way, but actually meeting their physical needs. Debbie tells us about the time that she had such a mental breakdown that she ended up as a drooling, shuffling mental patient in a psych ward. She shares how this experience would forever change how she viewed people.
I wasn't sad and depressed, I was manic. So I was excited. Nothing made sense. I talked so fast that, and then things that were coming out of my mouth that in my head, when they told me later, I was like, what? Because it was never in my heart. But everything was jumbled and confused. And
did you feel like something was wrong?
I didn't really, and that's obviously a bad sign. But yeah, so I was just like really, really manic. And anyway, somebody called a doctor to our house. They realised something was wrong, so our children all went to our family, and they called a doctor to the house, and they gave me medication. They said this pill will knock her out for 24 hours, and I think it was half an hour, and I was back awake, and just nothing would knock me out, and I was just go, go, go. And my husband, I remember, he would put his head on my chest, and I'd be heavy breathing, so he'd think I'd gone to sleep, and then I'd get back up. And then I would run around doing whatever it was that I did all night. And so, yeah, I went for days without sleeping. I went for days without eating, actually. And just because you forget to do the natural things, and the baby, they'd bring the baby, and I remember, like, I'd change nappies and I'd just throw them on the floor, and I just didn't have the physical strength. And people would come and see me, and I'm like, well, how come you didn't see all the nappies on the floor and think something was wrong? But I was always the strong one, and I was so excited about everything. And there was a prophetic side in that. I've learned that you become very spiritually aware in that zone of, you know, like the body and the mind all falling apart. You're very aware spiritually. So a lot of stuff I said made so much sense. But anyway, after a while, my husband was told that he needed to take me to mental health. And so I went in there, and they were convinced that you can only be this manic through drug and alcohol abuse. And I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. And if I've had half a glass of alcohol, I'm not overstating it, because it's pretty much only ever been sips for toasts at wedding. I don't drink alcohol, never have. And I just hate what it does to lives, human lives. And it's a hate of mine. So I just refuse to drink alcohol. But, and so, yeah, so obviously had got to that place somehow. But I've learned that God can use our darkest moments to do something spectacular. But anyway, I ended up having to be admitted to the hospital, the Logan Psych Ward, and it was in the psych ward that I had what I call a couple of life-changing moments. As I said, I've grown up, my parents were pastors in the Christian world, and I was to see a whole different side of life that I didn't really ever know existed. And my husband, he sat with me from 8 o'clock in the morning till they kicked him out every night at 10 o'clock, and then he'd be back at 8, and he just never left my side.
Oh, he's beautiful.
Yeah, so it was lovely. But I saw so many people there, no one visited them, nobody cared about them. And you know, I was very heavily drugged, and really, because my body was so pure, I got every side effect. So my tongue swelled, you know, I drooled continually, I had blurred vision. I couldn't walk, so it slowed me right down. So I was barely shuffling. It was such an effort to try and walk, just shuffling along and drooling. And
do you feel like the drugs did more bad than good?
Well, the thing is, I'm lucky that I don't remember most of it, because I was so manic. They actually said that, they said to Ron, she's as sick as you can be, and we can't promise that we can even get her back.
Wow.
So they said, yeah, as sick as you can possibly be, and they didn't really know whether they could get me back. So it was a really bad place.
They were throwing everything they could.
Yeah, to hit me really hard. But with my tongue swelling, one day I just remember a nurse giving me pills, and I tried to pop them in my mouth, and because my tongue was swollen, the pills and the water and everything just ran down the front of me, and she just looked at me like in total disgust, and I learned what it feels like. It's burnt into my very being of what it feels like to be looked at like you disgust me. And I learned what that felt like. And then I kept wanting to go to the bathroom the whole time, and they said that it was a mental fixation. But anyway, one night I went up to go to the bathroom. They said, it's the middle of the night, you don't need to go, get back to bed. And I said, I just want to go to the bathroom. And anyway, they threw me into what I called the padded cell. It was vinyl up the walls and just a vinyl-covered mattress. And I'm looking out the Venetian blind saying, get me security, I just want to use the bathroom. Anyway, they bought a bedpan and then they threw it on the floor in the dark. And I remember just for a moment waking up and like looking around, and I felt like I was in a prison, and I was like, Lord, I'm scared and I'm alone and I'm cold. I don't know where I am. Jesus, help me. I was really confused. I was just like, I woke up obviously from the medication or fully conscious, and I was just really confused and scared and alone. And I cried out to God, you know, Jesus, help me. I'm scared. And anyway, they came and they bought security, but it wasn't to help me. They put a needle in my butt and knocked me out. And I woke up in the morning and I'd wet the bed, and just, you know, the humiliation.
Mm.
I'm so glad to say that mental health has come such a long way in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
But I just all of those feelings that actually began to change my perception of the world, you know, and the things that actually went on from what I'd known and what I'd seen. And as I recovered, like, it was remarkable recovery, because I was on lithium and Lygactyl, and they said I'd be on it for life. And I saw a GP who was ill-informed and told me that I needed to come off all the medication because I was obviously allergic to it. Which I did. I came off all of the medication.
This was once you'd been released from the facility?
Yeah, so they had to fight to get me out. And that's kind of funny from a Christian perspective as well, because they say, do you hear voices? And I'd be saying, well, I believe I hear the voice of God. So they just ramp the medication up again.
Oh, no.
You know, because you're hearing voices.
Yeah.
And God's not real. So what is wrong with you? And so every time I tried to get out, you know, up more medication, because I believe that I had a living relationship with a living God. And my husband said to me, Debbie, you can't say that because you've got to get out of here, you know. And I'm like, I won't deny my God, you know. I'm not going to deny God. And Ron's just like, you just have to say you don't hear the voice of God. So I was like, okay. And they said, you're hearing the voice of God. And I'm like, no, not at the moment. So anyway, they let me go home. I realized what God had done in my heart through this whole experience. And so I guess through it, I lost the ability to judge, because one breath and I can be crazy off my nut.
Mm.
So how can I look at a drug addict that's been raised in this dysfunctional home, and how can I judge them? Because I learned that they're no different to me. If I'd have been raised in that family and in that environment, we can be, oh, well, I'd never do that. Mm. Yeah, you would. But, you know, I know we can say there, but for the grace of God go I, but I know it. I know it to the core of my being. So how can I judge someone in darkness and in a desperate situation? And we ended up in Eagleby and we fell in love with the people. I mean, I didn't even know what a bomb was when I went to Eagleby. Mm-hmm. You know, by pastoring there for 10 years, I could tell you where the heroin house was and where the marijuana house was. We knew where everything was. And we just would lay in homes with drug-infected homes, with broken people, just loving people. You know, no furniture, everything smashed and destroyed. And we'd just be trying to love people.
I had the pleasure of having a two-hour-long conversation with Evelyn Parsons, award-winning wedding hairstylist and salon owner, wife, and mum of five kids. In episode 19, Evelyn talks about taking care of her marriage and working together with her husband as a team when it comes to managing the balance of work, family, and children.
I'm the calm under pressure type,
mm-hmm.
but probably likely to overcommit.
Yeah.
And Greg is like more realistic about like what we can achieve, more likely to get like a bit kind of stressed or like overwhelmed is probably, because everyone says anxious. He's like very calm person, but I'd say yes, he'd get a bit overwhelmed and think, oh my gosh, I'm not going to enjoy tomorrow. It's looking really stressful. Mm. So I don't really say much to Greg until the day.
Surprise!
So every day we actually have like a little meeting.
Okay.
Somewhere either before he goes to do the kid drop-offs or when he gets back.
Okay.
And sometimes we'll have it at a cafe. We'll meet for a coffee.
Oh, that's nice.
Sometimes we do it at home. Sometimes we just liaise at work. So we, depending where we, it's a bit different every day. Depending
impromptu.
What, yeah, it's yeah. a bit impromptu, but we just know at some point in the morning we'll have like a between a 3 and 10 minute conversation about yeah. what today is going to look like.
Mm.
Where do you need to be at what time, and where do I need to be, and is there something yeah. we need to do now to make that work better?
I love it. I love the teamwork.
Yeah, yeah. It's all about the team.
It's not. Yeah. You've got your thing. I've got my thing.
Yeah.
You know, we'll say hi like ships passing in the night.
Exactly.
You're actually a team.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really important in a marriage, because otherwise you're actually self-destructing. I think. Mm. Like I hear like I'm an absorber of like information, and then I try and take that on and think about what that means to me. And I remember yeah. years ago, like reading a book, it's like a parenting book, but it was talking about a family unit, and it was saying like, if you're just two people, you can be like, if you're back to back, you're looking in opposite directions. You're like thinking about your own day all the time, or your own life. You know, you're still in a marriage, or you're still in a connection, but you're back to back.
Yeah.
Then you can be side to side, but then you're like two people, like workmates, kind of business. It's like a business transaction. It's yeah. like we're kind of, we can both see the same thing in front of us, but we're doing it like
next to
simultaneously, but not together.
Yeah.
Or if you do it face to face, then you're actually like connected, and that's when you're really powerful. Excellent. And it's always like one on their own versus like two. Like one on their own can do so much, and two can do like four people
yeah.
if you work together.
Yeah.
And we really had to learn that, because we certainly didn't know how to do that as well in the early years.
Yeah.
But now with the family, the size we have and what we juggle, it's definitely like the key.
Yeah.
Is that relationship negotiation. It's that working together. And in a way, I suppose, when I think about organization and what we do, it's almost like you've got extremes, because you've actually got like rigidity, like there's things that can't change, and like there's structure in the way I have to live to feel like I'm on top of things. Like yes. there's like a real structure of like what has to get done in a day or a week and how I want it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you actually have to have the opposite of that at the same time, and you have to have like extreme flexibility.
Yeah.
So that when that rigid plan changes, that you're okay with it.
Mm.
And that when you get the call from school or a staff member, like I could be at 8:15 in the morning in my pajamas at home thinking, okay, I'm going to work from home this morning. Mm. I'm going to have time with the baby. And then I'll get a text and say, someone's sick. We've got clients from 9 o'clock. And in 15 minutes, I've dressed, my makeup's on, and I'm out the door.
Yeah.
So there's that rigidity, but there's that extreme flexibility as well. Mm. And in our way, I just sort of think about it in my head. It's like, because I have little visual pictures, is yeah. that it's like there's like a rubber band that surrounds our family. And sometimes because of stuff that's going on with us or the kids, you have to like push one way more.
Yeah.
And then you come back to the middle, and you have to push another way more and come back.
Yeah.
And that means that I would say that most of the time I don't get stressed.
Yeah.
I just feel calm about it.
Did you in the earlier years get stressed?
I think I probably just overcommitted and like coped with it, but it wasn't healthy.
Mm.
And I think it had a negative impact on our marriage. So yeah. Greg was working full time and I was building my business. My business had sort of exploded. I was about, so it started in 2004, and by about 2009, so sort of 5 years in, like it was just going like
gangbusters. Yeah.
It was exploding, and it was amazing. Like it was exciting, but it was not going well for us necessarily, because Greg was working full time. And then when he'd get home, I would leave to do my thing. And I was also working through the days, juggling the boys were little then.
Yeah.
And we just felt like we were always having conflict. We were always like on the opposite sides of a disagreement. You know, it's like he would have one perspective about whatever we were doing and I would have a different. And we got to a point where we just said, this isn't working. Like, what are we going to do? You know?
Mm.
And I suppose there's a point at that stage where some people go, well, this isn't going to work. I'm moving on.
From the business or from each other?
From each other.
Oh, right.
Because really, like, the business becomes secondary at that point. You suddenly go, I've got this business, which is going great. Greg's got work, which is going great. Mm. And we're trying to make all these things work and learn how to like cope with like layers yeah. as you have kids and you have all these layers adding on.
Yeah.
So at that point we just said, well, we don't want to live like this. We got married to have a great life together, and we want a life that's flourishing. And I didn't feel like we were flourishing. So we spent like 12 months kind of working out what we had to do to get to a better place.
Mm.
And so that was when Greg decided to leave teaching to start his own business, because we recognized that for us, and this isn't like the key for everybody, you have to find what it is that makes you both face each other and be in that place. But for us, it was like we had to be in business together doing the same thing, and that was going to work.
Right.
And so Greg left teaching, started his business.
I really love chatting with Stacey McBride Wilson in episode 15. Stacey is a happiness and well-being coach and founder of the Healthy Happy Soul. Stacey's heart is to help women reach the fullness of who God has created them to be. This is part of Stacey's story, where she discovers that she is actually capable of so much more than she thought and how she ended up meeting her savior. Fun fact, we actually did this interview two times.
I went to the gym, I honestly nearly died, but there was something that shifted in me in that moment, and it was that I had made a positive decision for myself. I'd taken a positive action and I'd done something to take care of myself.
So that felt good.
Yeah, and it was so foreign compared to all these other decisions I'd made, which had ended up not so great.
Yeah.
So I went, right, I'm going to do that again, and I'm going to do that again, and I did that and kept doing that, and I really enjoyed it. And over time, the owner of the gym, who's now my very dear friend, she said to me, Stace, you know, you watch when I tell you to do something, you change. You really see what's going on. Have you ever considered studying fitness? And I thought, no way. Like, because of all the reasons I said, like, you know, I'm a single teenage mom who used to binge drink and smoke and like eat way too much McDonald's. Like, there is no way that I could be a fitness instructor.
Yeah.
But she was so encouraging, and she kept just really, you know, asking me and encouraging me. So I thought, well, what have I got to lose? Like, you know, if I do it, and even if this is like my hobby job while I'm studying school teaching, how great would that be?
So how old were you now at this point?
I was 18 and a half.
Okay.
Yeah, nearly 19. So I was still had a lot to go through my uni. Mm. I really loved the gym. I'd lost nearly all of the weight that I gained in my pregnancy. I was feeling really great. I'd gained lots of confidence. Yeah. So I was definitely in a better space.
What had happened to all the self-loathing?
Such a good question. I think there was still that deep down, but there was stuff shifting. So there was just that hole in my soul that only Jesus could fill.
Mm.
So, you know, I was gaining confidence, but it was for all the wrong reasons. It was because I was looking good now. And so, you know, people would show me attention or congratulate me because of my size, but there was still all that stuff that needed to be reconciled in my heart. Mm. So there was definitely improvement, but that overall transformation and that journey to full restoration and healing really only came when I gave my heart to Jesus.
That's good.
Yeah.
So when did you give your heart to Jesus?
Yeah. So I'd been a fitness instructor for about a year and I was, like I said, outwardly doing much better. I did have lots of positive input in my life, and life was better, but there was just still I still had questions, and I had that foundation of Jesus as a kid, but had walked away. So I had a friend just invite me to church one night, and I really was in a pretty low space. And I thought, what have I got to lose, you know? And so I went, and I had a desire to go back to church, but just the shame was keeping me away. And so I knew that I probably needed Jesus, but just felt like everyone's going to look at me. And again, in a small country town where everyone knows you, and most of the churches were full of an older congregation. And so I thought, they're all going to know me, they're all going to judge me. But it was really me just judging myself. And so I went to this church, which was really little, and it was Pentecostal. It was a little church plant. There was only about 20 people. And I was like, I've never met people like this ever. Like, they were just young and vibrant and alive. And it was so different to any expression of church I'd ever experienced. And I ended up down the front, blubbering mess. Yes, me, Jesus. Yes. Oh. And yeah, so I was in my early 20s, like just turned 20. And so that was just, a complete shift. Turned my upside down world right side up and really started a pretty profound transformation.
That is amazing. And by now you've got a 3-year-old.
Yeah, yep. So it's radical transformation for her as well. And a good thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And so then the healing work began, because as you know, when
at the moment when we give our lives to Jesus, it's not like this immediate bam and all your problems are gone.
Yeah. And there's, it's when the real work begins.
Yeah, yeah, really, it is when all the real work begins, hey, because all the pain and brokenness in our heart, it's still there, but now we've got Jesus to walk through it with us and to do that healing work.
Yeah, and I just, it's so true, and I just clung so tight to him. So as far away as I had run away from him, and I was really blessed in that season because I was cleaning houses to just bring in some income. So I was working part-time as a fitness instructor. I was cleaning a couple of houses a week, and I was studying and being a single mum. And I had this time cleaning, so 2 to 3 hours a couple of times a week. And I just go into the houses, blast some worship music. And it was just the most, it was honestly, you know, God really knows what we need. Like, he just withdrew me away and just had these really long periods for me just to worship and just to be with him. And you know, cleaning can be quite, I don't know. I like cleaning. I think when you really get into it, I hate getting into it.
Is that the word you're looking for?
That's the word I'm looking for.
Not for me. But I'm glad it is for you.
No, it's something I dread doing, but once I get into it, I'm like, oh, I love this.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, I don't know. I really found just that time just so transformational, and Jesus met me and did so much deep heart work when I was, you know, scrubbing bathtubs and, you know, all this time. So it was a really special season, and I'm really grateful for that.
This was such a great conversation that I had in episode 20 with Lisa Schroeder, tea drinker, artist, mum, and admirer of pretty things. You should check her out on Instagram, at Lisa Madge Designs. I'll put that in the show notes. Check out her beautiful artwork. In this part of our conversation, we talked about how as a busy mum with a business, she just thought that she had no time to paint. And it was this big dream of hers that one day when she retired, she would pick up the paintbrush and finally release the creativity inside of her. But then she came to this powerful realization that literally changed the course of her life and has blessed so many people as a result.
Doing my business with graphic design, what happened was I was doing quite a lot of creative stuff, but none of it was very artistic. It was very commercially based, and I was really busy doing it all the time. And what happened was I found myself, especially when I had two really little kids, I was like, if I wasn't working really hard, I was wiping bottoms and wiping mashed potato off the floor and doing mum stuff. And it was very intense. Like, you know, little kids are just so needy of your time. And I remember just being really stretched between doing this commercial art and then looking after kids. And my heart would say, can't wait until I retire so that I can paint. And I would just like console myself that that's what I would do. So I'd be like, oh, I have to do this job now, but I just can't wait until I retire and then I'll have time to paint. And then I would be like looking after kids and I'd be crying or I need to put them down or do the washing or something like that. And my heart would be wanting to do something creative. And I would just say to myself, I can't wait until I retire so that I can paint. And I had this dream that I would be like this retired 65-year-old woman and I have a studio to myself and I just paint whenever I wanted to and I would just be like gloriously happy. And it kind of got to the point where I had to stop myself from saying that. And I'm like, why am I putting it off? Why do I have to wait 25 years to do something that I really enjoy? And one of the reasons was I thought I didn't have time, but I kind of made a decision that if I've only got 15 minutes, then that's all I'm going to do. I'm only going to paint for 15 minutes and it's not going to be a work of art. It's going to be something on the paper and I'm just going to do it. And I made a really deliberate decision to start painting when I had really little kids.
I love that, just 15 minutes a day. So had you ever painted before that?
I was a really creative kid. Like, I was drawing on every scrap of paper that I could find in the house. And if I wasn't reading books, I was drawing on something. And I remember I actually begged my dad to build me an art studio downstairs under the house, and we had one of these old-fashioned open air Queenslanders house that was up on the poles. And so under the house wasn't even a room. It was like a dust bowl. But I had a desk, and he would get me slabs of Masonite building material that was off cuts and put them on the desk. And I had these old, you know, half dried out paint tubes, and I was so happy painting in this little dust bowl of a studio. And that was like, I was like 13 or 14. So I've always had it in me, but when I was kind of doing the corporate career and little babies, there was just, I didn't have any space in my life for it. And so it took a bit to get back into it.
So those 15 minutes, were they when the kids were napping or at night when they had gone to sleep?
Yeah, or little bits and pieces. It was usually when the kids were asleep and I didn't have a pressing deadline, I would just stop and paint. Or if they were happy and my husband was home, or my husband had taken me out to the park, I'd just sit and paint. And I mean, it wasn't what I would call this huge explosion of art in my life, but it was the decision that I made just to get started. And of course, then I fell in love with watercolors. I went out and bought myself a $6 Aldi watercolor set, little paint tins, and a piece of paper.
Such
and
an investment. Pad. Yeah.
I know. And I thought, well, I'm just going to paint. And if I really enjoy it, then I'm going to go out and spend more money and buy some proper supplies. And I loved it. And I just got mesmerized by what I could produce. And I mean, looking back, they're actually pretty rubbish compared to what I do now, 4 years later. But it was like something inside of me needed to express itself, and I needed to let that out. And so honoring that was just such a joy for me.
Okay, we have just one more to go. This excerpt is from episode 29 with Pastor Emma Laurie Cook, who together with her husband Jared are the Campus Hillsong pastors of Sunshine Coast South. If you haven't already, check out the whole episode, because Emma's story is that after 8 years of a previous marriage, at the age of 30, Emma found herself single and divorced. And we talk about the process that she went through toward healing and restoration and what God says about divorce. But I chose to include today one part of her story that happened more recently, where she walked through 2 miscarriages. So talking about social media, I read that your baby girl, Indy, that she's a miracle baby.
Yes. Yes, she is.
How so?
Right. Well, obviously you can tell the gap in our kids. We've got a 5-year-old and a 9-month-old. You know, I was very blessed to fall pregnant really easily with Jensen, our firstborn. You know, a year after our wedding, I thought, oh yeah, let's try for kids. And before we knew it, we were pregnant. I was about 36 years old at that point, and was so blessed by God to, you know, like in my first marriage, I laid down that dream of having children. So I was pretty pumped to fall pregnant so easily. Oh, yeah. And then just didn't think anything of it when we went to go have a second. At first, it took me a little while to fall pregnant. And then I finally did. And then I miscarried in my first trimester, towards the end of my first trimester, beginning of the second trimester. Yeah. And learned firsthand what is really common for so many women, what that is like. Again, it gave me a first-hand experience of what women feel when they lose a child, which was really foreign to me. I just didn't really have friends that had miscarried, or maybe friends haven't talked to me about it. Nobody in my family has gone through it. So that was a steep learning curve. And then about another year later, Again, thought, okay, I'm emotionally ready. Let's try and have another baby again. Again, it took us a little while. And I had a second miscarriage at the beginning of my second trimester. Mm. And I felt sideswiped a little by the journey, because you think after having your first child that you're not someone who's going to have issues.
Yeah.
And at that time, I had a lot of people in the medical field just telling me, oh, well, it's because you're approaching 40 years old. This is just what's going to happen. And really had a lot of negative medical reports, but not based on really facts. And so I rang a GP, of mine, who's a friend, and said, hey, look, I've just had a second miscarriage. Doctors are just telling me that, you know, it's my age and this is just what comes with your age. I said, but there's got to be more I can look into with this.
Yeah.
He very quickly hooked me up with an appointment with IVF Australia. And I'll never forget the feeling of sitting in that waiting room, waiting for the specialist, thinking, I never pictured in my life that I would be here. Yeah. It was actually a really unusual space, because here I had gone through laying down the dream of children altogether.
Yeah.
I was actually very grateful for my first son, and I didn't have this drive in me like, you have to have another child. I felt so graced by, so blessed by God that I'd already had a son.
Yeah.
But just felt like there was a, oh, we'd love a sibling for Jensen, you know, and
yeah.
God, I've got some faith in my heart that I reckon you could do this.
Mm.
And then spoke with the specialist, who just, he doesn't know it, but spoke life straight into my heart, said, look, I've looked at your medical records. Yeah, you are 40 and probably not got a lot of time left, but I think it would be a matter of time until you're going to have good news. Mm. And then my next pregnancy was Indy. Yeah. And yeah, so glad I stuck there in that journey. But it's a really real journey for women, hey. And actually, yeah. I read today is, let me just try and get the wording for you.
Okay.
Because this will be really helpful for your listeners. It is National Infertility Awareness Week this week.
Oh, okay.
And I love that as a society we talk about this stuff way more often.
Mm.
And we can get really real on it, because there's probably more women out there that go through fertility issues than more women than we realise.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm.
Yeah, I know so many women actually who have been through miscarriages, and it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is, because your body goes through all the whole process of what happens when you fall pregnant. Like,
yeah.
You know, I had gained weight. I had the hormones happening. You know, already going for scans, and you're doing the whole process. Mm. And then obviously your body goes through a natural labor, and you've got the bounce back factor even on your body afterwards. And so it's not like it's this little event that just kind of happens and goes away. It actually, it felt like a 12-month process, you know, each time. Yeah. And so the enemy would just love to whisper in women's ears at that point and go, you know, like, this is just going to keep happening to you, or your promise isn't going to come. And I would just say to them, you have no idea. If you just hope one more time and you stir faith one more time, you actually give heaven the ability to perform a miracle in your life. And so very similar, I suppose, to the process of with my first husband. I was like, you know what, I've got grace within me to keep going and try this again.
Mm-hmm.
And so glad we got Indy. She's just the delight of our lives. She's incredible. So thank God we kept giving it another go.
And there we have it. 7 excerpts from 7 conversations that really impacted me in this first year of podcasting. I'm looking forward to this next year and have lots of great guests lined up and coming your way, including women from all sorts of walks of life.
If you have any suggestions of someone you would like me to interview, or you would like to share your own story with us, DM me on Instagram at mel_linem or contact me on Facebook. Friend, let me tell you that you are a valuable daughter of God, and He wants to see you living life to the full in every area of your life. He is faithful, and we can see that in our own stories and in the stories of others. I hope you are being encouraged, inspired, and I hope you are being equipped to live out your calling every day of your life. Talk to you soon.